It's been a while since you put me on the shelf. I know you've been distracted by somebody else. It's been a while, but that's all right, you see. And I'll be right here waiting when you want to play again with me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Cult of the Old. I'm Matt Thrower, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Ian McAllister and Nate Owens. How are you doing, gentlemen?
I am good, Matt. How are you yourself?
I would be better if I didn't have kale in my shoes.
I mean, that's not where kale traditionally goes.
No.
Are you using it as some sort of like a warming thing? I mean, socks are a thing. They are invented.
No, I was cooking with some earlier and somehow managed to make its way into my footwear.
I was going to say, times must really be tough in the UK.
Yeah. Oh, you have no idea.
We're lining the shoes with kale over here. I'm fine too, by the way. This is Nate Owens.
I'm glad you haven't had to resort to any vegetable-based insulation in where you live. Each episode, I and my fellow hosts are going to dive deep into the tabletop gaming past, deeper than normal in this particular episode. We are going to turn back the release schedule at least 10 years to look at some games that were setting tables ablaze in the dim and distant past of a whole decade ago. In the previous season, we covered games that were looking either available in physical form or in legal digital means. This season, we're throwing that rule out so we can enjoy ourselves more by covering a wider range of games that we nonetheless think are important to talk about. Where we can, we will point you towards plays to play the games that we are covering. And the one we're talking about tonight is freely available at retail, so you needn't worry about that for this evening. And what we're turning our minds to is the subject of influential designers. And there's one name that stands out at the top of everyone's list, and that's Dr. Rainer Nitzia, a designer with somewhere in the region of 700 titles to their name. Most of us have a favourite Nitzia title, and this shows to this show are no exception. The Good Doctor is famous for many games and is associated with many mechanisms that feature time and again in his designs. One of those is auctions. And in our game tonight, we'll be visiting art auctions across the world, buying up the finest pieces for the least amount of money and making huge profits. Or so we hope. Open your doors and put on your finest pieces on display. Classic theme of modern art. Ian, I believe you have volunteered yourself for the one-minute breakdown of this incredibly
simple game. Yes, that's the person who's played this game the least. It's definitely mine. Yay. We need a timer.
Ready. Go.
So, in the game of modern art, you are looking to make the most money by buying and selling art from across the world. You do that in a series of auctions. Every round, players will put a card on the table that represents a piece of art, and that'll have a type of auction on it. Maybe it'll be a closed, hidden auction, maybe it'll be an open auction, maybe a one-price auction, or some other type in there. Players complete these auctions, art is bought and put in front of them, and then at the end of the round, art is valued by the most cards of that artist that are on the table. So the art, so the most cards on the table is worth the most, then the second's worth second most, and so on and so forth. The fourth and fifth artists are worth absolutely nothing at all. Then you're forced to sell all the art that's in front of you for whatever price it is, even if it's zero. You have four or five rounds of this, and at the end of the game, the person with the most money is the winner.
Very good, with 11 seconds to spare. A nice summary there of the game of modern art. So, what is modern art, other than a blight on the artistic landscape?
Tonight on Cult of the Art.
Yes.
We will discuss this and many other issues.
the game of modern art. Modern art in its, you know, in its modernity was invented sometime in the 1920s, I think. I don't know. But the game of modern art that we're discussing tonight was 1992. It was designed, of course, by Rainer Nitzia. And the original publisher was Hans im Glück in German. And there was a Mayfair edition that came out in English in 1992. But there have been reprints from many different publishers. The current English edition is available from Simon. There have been quite a lot of artists involved in this, so I'm not going to read them all out. It depends on the edition, as you can probably imagine, in a game with needs lots of modern art pictures to put on display. The art's varied, and it hasn't actually won that many awards. It was nominated, recommended, the 1993 Spiel des Jahres, and it also won the 1993 Deutsche Spielpreis Best Family Adult Game winner. There are no different versions of this game and no expansions, but there are different publications and they...
There are different versions. There is the ridiculously titled Modern Art The Card Game.
Oh, yes.
Which is a separate game, and I used to have it, but I think I played it once and I don't remember very well. It actually did not revolve around auctions. It was like a set collection game, really light, but eventually was themed. It was originally Master's Gallery, but now I'm saying this out loud, I should go on the Board Game Geek Mobile and find out. But there was a Modern Art The Card Game, even though this is a card game.
Yeah, I got very excited at Tabletop Scotland this year because there was a copy of Modern Art in the auction showing for £5. And I was like, yes, I will buy that because I played it a little previous to that. And it turned out it was the card game version. I was like, no, that's not what I wanted. Ooh.
I was just going to finish up there by saying that unusually this is a game where the different editions actually, they kind of have a meaningful impact on gameplay in certain respects. But I think we're going to come on and talk about that much later on. So right now, we're just going to have a quick chat about how we first came across it.
Well, this is actually one of those games. I think if you're in the hobby long enough, you end up having games that you've owned twice. And there's a few that have fallen in that category. And inevitably, if I got rid of it once, I'm probably going to get rid of it a second time. But that has not happened with Modern Art. I had the Mayfair edition. I think I got it. Oh, it would have been 2008, 2009, somewhere in there, and from a Barnes & Noble in the U.S. And I had that, and I played it a number of times, and it kind of eluded me. It didn't really click for me, and I ended up trading it away. And then in the years after that, I kind of became a real fan of Reiner Knizia's work and his work as a designer. And I'm probably the biggest apologist here. I'm much more so than Matt, I believe. And... because of that, I kind of wanted to get back into it. I was kind of collecting a lot of his other games. And by that time, the game had gone out of print. And so I kind of watched the skies to see if it would get reprinted. And sure enough, it was by Simon. And that's the edition I ended up buying. So I bought that. I still have that. And I still play it whenever I get a chance. I really enjoy it. I'm sorry. Hold on. I found out Modern Art, the card game, it is currently under that title, also published by Simon. But it was formerly known as Master's Gallery. It was formerly known as, previously before that, was Modern Art, the card game. So it's gone through a few versions. But the idea is collecting sets of artwork, a really light little card game. So there you go.
Fair enough. Yeah, this one's been on my radar for a while. It's partly because I think we talked about it during our sort of season one prep for Call of the Old. We like mentioned Modern Art, and I was sort of aware that I hadn't really played many Knizia titles, and it was a fairly well-regarded one. There's a new games cafe opened up in Edinburgh called Ancient Robots Games. Really nice, down the bottom of Leaf Walk. And I was there with a few friends earlier in the year, and they had the Simon version in their library. So I pulled it out, read the rules, which are incredibly short. We'll come to that, I'm sure. And we just powered through a game, really, really enjoyed it. Easy to teach, quick to play, really interesting to manipulate those auctions. Although we said at the start, like, it's readily available at retail at the moment, I think there's a reprint coming at the moment. So it's a little hard to get at the moment, though Simon are still printing it. There's just a reprint kind of on the way at the moment. So I'm eagerly awaiting that because I will definitely be adding it to my collection.
Me, I came to it fairly late. I've always been a fan of auction games. I've always liked them, but I'd never played Modern Art, and I'd heard it compared favorably with other classics of the genre. And so I picked up the Simon edition when it came out a few years ago, and it proved a fairly popular lunchtime game, which came as a surprise to me. I played it at work. We had a work lunchtime club, which generally went for very, very light games like Ticket to Ride and Sushi Go. So I was kind of surprised at this, although it's no more complicated than those games, it's a bit more involved, and I'm kind of surprised it went down as well as it did. And after that wound up with COVID, it hasn't really hit my table again, but that's more to do with circumstance than lack of enjoyment, I would say. But I'm not enormously experienced with it. I've played it maybe half a dozen times. Moving on then, I mean, one of the interesting things about doing this particular episode is the age of the game, 1992. This is older than games that I think we've covered before. But have we managed to grub up any information about possible influences on the game?
I'll let Nate go first on that one.
Yeah, I mean, we've run into this issue a few times. The board gaming does not have a very strong... There haven't been a lot of historians for board gaming. I would love that. I would love if someone had really taken it on themselves, because we're at this point now where the oldest masters of the genre have actually passed away at this point, and it would be really useful. But, and this is a game I think would really benefit from that, because there's not a lot of documentation. It's published in 1992. It's much earlier than a lot of hobby games. It's early in that cycle, really, when it's before Catan. Yeah. When it's pre-Catan, that's sort of the dividing line of like where the game lies, you know. And because of that, there's not a lot of precedent in terms of there's not a lot of documentation for the design process, not for lack of interaction with Dr. Kinesia, because he's very available. He's been in a lot of interviews, but just not this one's been elaborated on. But there is a really strong tradition of bidding and auctioning in games. If we're going to look at games that we kind of consider designed games, something like Monopoly has an auction component. If a property is not sold, you auction it off. Now, it does not have... It clearly assumes a familiarity with auctions in the rules, because the way Monopoly writes the rules for the auction, it just says, oh, just have an auction. Okay. You know, but that's been in the rules for a very long time. It's really there. And then, of course, we have games that involve bidding of some kind, something like Bridge. A lot of trick-taking games involve forming some kind of contract. You say, I'm going to make this much, and then you're expected to make that much, or else you lose it. In the U.S., we like playing spades a lot. I don't know if that's played in the U.K. very much, but spades has a similar kind of thing. You set a bid as a partner and say, we'll make this many points. And that's very common. That's been a very widely used mechanic in folk games, what I call folk games, games played with playing cards and dice and stuff like that. So in that sense, it's got a very deep lineage. And it's, you know, I don't know if I'd call those auction games as we think about this one, and we'll come to that later. But I think if we're looking at background information, I think that's the most obvious inspiration I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, that seems fair to me. Like you say, there's a lot of bidding in traditional card games. I mean, I guess the world of gambling has a bit of an influence on this as well, maybe, in that way, because like auctions exist in that world, certainly, or that sort of style of betting, effectively on the outcome. I guess I have a little bit of that. But yeah, I mean, this game is well before my time, so I don't really know a huge amount about it, so like how it came to be.
As Nate mentioned there, I know that Dr. Nitzi does a lot of interviews, and I've had the pleasure of interviewing him myself a couple of times. He's a lovely interviewee. He's fascinating to talk to, always very polite and genial. And he always wears one of his delightfully bright trademark bow ties. But I've never asked him about modern art myself, and I've never found anything. I did do a trawl of some old interviews where he was asked directly about the inspiration for modern art, but from the fact I've spoken to him, I think we can intuit two things about it. First of all, as it's quite well known, he is a mathematician. I think he has a doctorate in mathematics. Of course he has. Dr. Reiner Nitzi, of course he has, yeah. And one of the things about maths that fascinates him is the maths of auctions. He's talked to me about this. He's just gone off on one because he loves it. In talking about it during an interview, it's clearly something that he's deeply, deeply interested in. And so from a game design standpoint, it's kind of really grist for his mill, the idea of having an auction game in which he could throw as many different combinations of auction as you possibly could, because as Ian said at the start, this is one of the standout things about modern art, is it has so many different types of auction in it. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is that he's also well known in interviews for stating, perhaps surprisingly, that he starts his designs with a theme first. And I think that really comes across in modern art, which again, we're going to talk to later. It's not obvious to start with, but there is an extraordinary, almost semi-satirical take of the art world hidden behind the mathematics of the auction in this one. So I think between those two things, between the fact that he loves the auctions and that he loves to start with a theme, I'm pretty sure that's all the inspiration you need to explain modern art. You know, we are going back all this time to a point where it was perhaps easier to find, not easier, but you could find a fresh idea without finding that somebody had beaten you there before it, you know? And there was perhaps less inspiration going on from game to game than there is, less cross-fertilization than there is nowadays. So again, we're faced with the same problem when we discuss how we felt the impact of the game was when it came out at the time in 1992.
I mean, I was not there at the time, basically. I mean, it's way before my time in the hobby, way before my time in the hobby. Its name had been ringing out more in recent years, I think, part and thanks to the new edition from Simon, and it's had some reviews from sort of bigger sites in recent years as well. But yeah, I can't really speak to the impact of the time because I don't know.
I mean, we talk about auction games now, and yeah. I'm not sure we did before modern art. You know, I was not in the hobby. I was, you know, a grade schooler at the time. So, you know, I mean, I can't confirm or deny that. But the idea that we have the idea of auctions, of auction game as a genre. And Matt didn't point this out in his when he was talking just now, but in our show notes, he actually did point out that the 1979 Dune game uses an auction. And it's actually kind of a cutthroat auction because there's a lot of hidden information in it. And so auctions had been used in designer games before this time, but I'm not sure if we can find one that centered around auctions exclusively. Not exclusively, because there's other things happening here because of the auctions. But this game is like, it's auctions all the way down. And because of that, Reiner Knizia is now used the mechanic in a lot of other ways, sometimes very directly in games like Ra and Medici. And those are both good. I love Ra. That's might be my favorite game by him. And those are pure auction games, but he's used it in a lot of other ways. He used it in the Beowulf game. This is a almost totally forgotten game now, about almost 20 years old, but I really like it. It uses auctions. There's a modified auction used in Taj Mahal. That uses auctions in Amun-Re, all of these games by Knizia that have used them as well. So, and that's to say nothing of the tiny little card games like High Society and stuff like that. So it almost feels like we're seeing two things exploding at once here. One of those is the kind of the birth of a genre as we understand it. And the second thing is kind of a coming out party for one of our most important designers now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think this predates everybody here. I was 18 in 1992. No, I was younger than that. Oh, I can't remember now, but it's, I can't do the maths either. That's how rubbish I am.
I was 12.
I am the oldest then, but nevertheless, it's still before my time, before I was playing modern board games. But the thing that really struck me, about this when I looked, and I'd never thought this before until we came to do this show, is that it came out in 1992, which is before Catan.
Yep.
And yet it's not seen as being this kind of big influential brick of the hobby like that game is, and nor is it seen in the same, you know, in the same light as Hoity Toity, which you've mentioned a couple of times in previous episodes, which I think was 1990.
Yeah.
Adelverpflichtet.
Ian's the one who's taken more German than me. That's just, yes. That's me hearing the word said at some point.
I was one terrible at translating
so
that.
the importance of hoity-toity, for those who don't know, was that it was one of the very first games to get an English localization from Germany.
Exactly, which is what I was going to say.
Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, the point is that that had an early English edition, and I think that's why modern art isn't mentioned in the same breath as those games, because it didn't get an English edition until 1996 with Mayfair. So it's a shame, really, because I think it ought to. I think it ought to be seen as part of that super influential cabal that kind of brought Euro games to the shores of Britain and America. But it isn't, which is, and I don't know. Let's start that movement to rectify that right here on this podcast, gentlemen.
Yeah.
It's weird it didn't get an English edition until then, because it's so, the components are so language independent. All you really need to do is like reprint the rulebook and box it up and send it across.
But would there be a market for it? This is the thing. This was odd beast, even in 1996. True. That's a bit of a commercial risk.
That's true. You know, and you can even say, like, when I think about German board games from that era, now, granted, the ones we think of now are the ones that have survived, right? But they tend to be very family-oriented. They tend to be pretty light and breezy for the most part. Things like Hoity Toity, but before that, there's games like Cafe International, which is very simple. Scotland Yard, which also won this Spiel des Jahres. Alf Oxa, which is a trucking game, like a pickup and deliver game. The German ethos at the time was, these are like just kind of breezy family games. There's some strategy, but not, they're not brain burners. But modern art actually has some teeth to it, strategically, in a way that kind of sneaks up on you. And I would never want to presume to say, like, this is sort of the start of, like, the heavy German game, what would become the Euro game. But it seems like an early entry into that. Of course, the big game, that the heaviest German game, was Die Macher, which actually came out in the 80s in its first edition and is a monster of a game. So that probably blows my theory out of the water. But certainly, as in the 1 hour, 90 minute weight class, this is an unusually meaty game for that era.
Yeah, that's the key thing I think you've just identified there. It's that combination of accessibility and weight, because Die Macher is a heavy game in every regard. It's heavy,
yeah,
with rules,
it is
heavy with strategy, literally heavy if you pick it up. And modern art is not. It's very accessible. In fact, I would argue it's easier to learn than Catan or Hoity Toity. But it, as you say, has hidden depths as you peel back the layers underneath. So this obviously seems like a nice segue into the segment where we talk about how we feel about the game, you know, what we think about it, how we felt about playing it. So it's time for some critical opinions.
Well, as the person who's only played it a single time, I've literally only played it once, and it stuck in my head for a few days afterwards. It was that kind of game where I was just like kind of blown away by it. It's a sort of game where you read the rule book and go, this sounds incredibly pedestrian and dull. And then you play it and you kind of realize how good The Good Doctor is. I just like making a simple game have like life to it. The first round just feels like an okay auction game. You just try and figure out how to sort of, you know, get the most money for what's in your hand. And I think it's a great game to play if you just want to get a feel for auctions in games in general, because it literally has all the auction types I can think of. There might be others that I don't know about. It's got open auctions, it's got one-offer auctions, it's got hidden auctions, and it's got one price auctions. So those are the four main auction types in the game. So you get a feel for all of those. And then each of those auctions has kind of its own subtleties. And even on a first play, I could see that like some of the folk around the table gravitated towards one type of auction or another, or knew about one auction over another. And I think the nature of the game probably means that you at some point need to master them all. Like get a handle on how to do all those auctions well. And I still don't know. After one play, I don't know how to do that at all. But I mean, we said in the previous segment there, it does have some like subtleties to it. There's a really interesting dynamic in hitting the number of artist cards required to end a round. Because like once you get to five artist cards out around the table, or at least that's in the CMON edition, I don't know if previous editions had slightly different rules, that round ends, and it ends as soon as those cards hit the table, so the final auction doesn't happen. And there is another type of card that we haven't mentioned, which is the double auction, where you basically play an artist and you play another card by that artist, so you put two cards down by the same artist at the same time, and that can just like end the round instantly from three cards to five, and that might jump that artist up to being the most valuable that round, which is a nice little sort of like or a strategic take that kind of almost element in it, which I really, really liked. And it means that players have to adapt a bit as well, because if one artist is doing well in one round, there's a limited number of cards in that deck and every artist is represented equally. So you have to sort of smooth things off a little bit, I guess, over the few rounds. I really like that the auctioneer on some you have to pay the auctioneer on some outcomes. I think that adds a little bit of spiciness to some of the auctions. So like that is it the one price auction, like if no one buys it, the auctioneer basically gets the art for free. Things like that exist within the game. So there's a lot of really interesting little twists and like little cul-de-sacs you can go down and actually sort of to manipulate how things are going around the table. Nate's just looking up in the rule book right now to check that I'm correct.
The auctioneer must pay the bank for the painting.
Oh yeah, it's that one where the auctioneer gets punished. So one price auction, the auctioneer says a price, and if no one else buys it, the auctioneer has to pay that money.
Yeah. But you might do that on purpose.
You might
set a price no one else is interested in and you want to get it yourself.
You want my card because it's worth money. Yep. Absolutely. It's still sort of stuck slightly in my brain. It's kind of why I want to pick it up and play it a bit more.
I'm going to be the dissenter on this one, I think. I know Nate likes it a lot and has played it a lot. And not that it's a bad game. I don't think it's a bad game. It's a fun game. I've had a good time with it and I've enjoyed it. But I just don't like it as much as the auction games. I don't like it as much as Ra, which I think is superb. And Nate's already mentioned as a brilliant game. I was playing For Sale earlier this week. Pulled that out again with some friends and was reminded how enjoyable that is. And over the last, well, it's going back a year or so now, but I've had a good time with Furnace, which I'm going to talk about a bit later, which is a modern descendant, I think, of modern art. It's there's a lot more to it than just the auction, but it's a classic Euro-esque auction game, or has resurrected that concept for the modern market. So there are a number of auction games I think I like more than modern art. And I've been puzzled. Really, I've thought quite a bit about exactly why that is, because I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's got something to do with the rhythm of the game. The way that the auctions change with every artist or every card that goes down feels like it's pulling a rug out from under you the whole time. It forces you to chop and change, and the way that you're thinking, the way that you're evaluating things, the way that you're going about thinking about what you can afford and what things are worth, especially when you factor the kind of weird end game scoring where some artists can be worth a lot and some artists can be worth nothing into the equation. And that kind of, it kind of sucks the tension out of proceedings. What I really like in auction games, the thing that I particularly love in Ra, is when you can or get caught, when you frame another player on the hook, or you get caught in the hook for yourself, where you don't know if you dare bid or whether you dare leave it. Those moments, it's just like a bear pit of being just trapped under a glass, the bell jar kind of style thing, like with somebody shining a light in on you and you're burning on the points of that decision as to whether or not can you afford to take this, or is it going to be worse if you leave it? I love that feeling. It's absolutely incredible. And I love even more, especially in Ra, setting it up for other people, knowing that you're going to you pull a tile and knowing that they're going to be thrashing on the decision of whether to take that block or not. And you just don't get that in modern art. It's missing that until right at the end of the game. And I find that, isn't it? I find that off-putting. It's just not quite as much fun because it's missing that element. That other auction games or some other auction games seems to have. I do think it's very admirable how slim it is in terms of teaching it. Again, I'm going to be making a lot of comparisons to Ra, but those who've played it will know it has the most absurdly intricate scoring mechanic where different sets of one thing influence different sets of other things depending on you've got, and sometimes they're not sets, sometimes they're single, and some things are bad and some things are good, and it's all printed around the edge of the board in these extraordinary hieroglyphics that still puzzle me even though I know them quite well. And but I do think at the same time, and I think this is true of a lot of Euro games, it's not quite as intuitive as gamers seem to think it is. You know, although bidding and auctions, as we've discussed, has a long history in gambling and other aspects of play, particularly that end game scoring thing again, does make it not easily accessible to people who are not familiar with gaming for the sake of games. It's not particularly kind of intuitive, and it makes you think hard about it. It makes you think about things in mathematical terms, quite nakedly mathematical terms, I suppose, and that's not something that people are used to. There is this whole aspect of the theme that I think Nate would be better placed to talk about because he put it in the show notes.
Well, I didn't put it in the show notes. I'm not the first one to articulate it. I'm just the first one to get it written in the Google document.
You expressed it very nicely, though.
Well, yeah, I really enjoy modern art, but it has snuck up on me. And actually, Matt, I think that a lot of your criticisms there aren't off base, because modern art is not the same kind of game as Medici or Ra. It's a different experience, which is one reason I like having both around. And I think it kind of comes down to this feel. I actually think a lot of people, like I said, I mentioned earlier that the game eluded me when I first played it. Like, I didn't quite know what am I doing here? It's surprisingly opaque for as slim and stripped down as the design is. And I think that comes down to a couple of things. I think one is Kanitsa these days is known as he is a mathematician. And I think actually one of his brilliant things is, and I say this as someone who's a big fan, if I had to pick one designer to just follow him and like buy a bunch of his games, it would be him. And I have more of his games than any other designer. And I think that there's a couple of things there that he's really good at. One is that he is very mathematically fine-tuned, but he doesn't make games deterministically mathematic, which I think is, that's what grates on me when I start dealing in numbers, is I feel like I'm dealing with absolute values. And value is never absolute in modern art. It's not very predictable, and it's not it's very elastic. And even, I wouldn't venture to say chaotic, because that makes it sound more bonkers than the game is. It is a strategy game, but you can, again, a painting's value, when you sell a painting, it's not obvious all the time, and it takes a lot of practice actually to be able to see it, and it's just sometimes just very ambiguous. I think a lot of gamers, when they first hit it, can kind of bounce off of it some, and especially I think this was true in the late 90s, early aughts, as the hobby was kind of calcifying, as it was kind of creating, you know, when it was becoming a hobby. I think a game it's really kind of a squishy game. It's very human. Like, a lot is happening above the table, and a lot is, you're trying to predict what someone else will value. And I think that's where I do disagree with you, Matt. I think you do get those points of trying to set up other people and trying to kind of anticipate what people will value and trying to manipulate that. You do get that, but it's just, you can't get nearly as many angles, and it's not very predictable all the time.
It's almost got a sort of party game feel to it, I thought. When I the only time I played it, it felt like a sort of slightly more complicated kind of party style game almost, because you've got those weird interactions around the table. Like you say, so much of that play is happening
right
above the table. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And you know, and I love the good doctor's designs as a rule. And I like some that are very obscure. Like, he released a Hobbit board game in like 2010 that I think is really fun. He did that Beowulf game that it's been completely forgotten. I think it's great. He's got all sorts of games like this. So I'm an easy mark for his stuff, but this is a weird one from him. And it is because it's an early one, right? He was still cutting his teeth a little bit. I think that human aspect was a hard sell when in like the early board game geek days. But I think now gamers have become a lot more comfortable with games that are weirdly human. We talked about Cosmic Encounter last year. Cosmic Encounter is more successful now than at any point in its history. And I think a big part is that people just sort of get the almost like postmodern kind of quality of it, that it's not like these games weren't successful before, but I think there's something in the ether now that people grasp them easier. And that's true for me too. I really enjoy modern art. I think there's and I'm just going to keep on talking because that's the thing that I do. The two things that I think really set it apart, aside from the auctions, the first one that's really has a lot of teeth to it, is this idea that you pay the person who put the auction up, who started the auction. They get the money. And that is a really tricky thing. And at the end of the hand, and Ian explains some of this, but at the end of the hand, you sell back the paintings, and the artists, the three highest artists, the three artists who sold the most paintings are the only ones who make any money, but there's five artists in the game. You can have as many as five artists selling paintings. And so that means that whatever you buy, you can sell back and hopefully make a profit. But it's extremely possible to win this game without ever buying an auction, without ever buying a painting, because you have a good eye for the auctions and you can tell what people will want to buy. I think that's really interesting. And it has a really kind of unbalancing effect. If someone isn't bidding smartly, they can give someone the game.
Yeah.
It's absolutely possible. That drives me crazy on one level, but the longer I've sat with the game, the more I appreciate it, because it just tells you, like, okay, go deeper, figure out how are you going to do this? This happened last time. In that sense, it's a game that really rewards familiarity. And it's one of those games, there's always kind of deeper to go with it. So I find those kind of things really fascinating. It's a really rewarding game. The other thing that I really like is the fact that those three, the three most popular artists sell. And that's cumulative over four rounds. So an artist continues to become more and more popular, and it's all groupthink. That's the most amazing thing. It's not because that artist did anything. And this is where that satirical side comes in. And we'll talk about that, I think, kind of as we get into the next section about the influence. But it's not, these paintings don't have any value in and of themselves. They are just value because everyone decided they were valuable. It's the fiat currency of auctioning. And that's really impressive. That's a really neat piece of design. And the fact that it's done with like four pages of rules is, it's just a really tight rule set. It is not easy to understand. Matt is right about that. I actually prefer Raw as well. And I think I like this better than For Sale, but For Sale is a killer game. Really, really good. But Raw is also a much more bounded game. It's not going to completely go pear-shaped like this game will if you let it. But there's trade-offs to all that kind of stuff. So I think this is a really impressive design, but it does ask something of you.
Yeah, I hadn't really sort of grasped the whole shape of it until like the end of our first game. I was like, oh, okay. I kind of see it now. And then I was like, I kind of want to go back into that and have another shot. Because it's got that to it for sure. So it's just like it reveals itself over the course of a game.
Before we move on, I just want to go back over something you were talking about there, Nate. It's quite interesting. What you said was very interesting. There's some angles there that I certainly had to consider in terms of the depth of the game, especially as regards sort of like paying the player that plays the card. There's a tongue twister for you. But what gets me about this game, I think, is quite, because I really like games. I think there's a real dearth of games that make you very uncertain about the value of things at any given point in time. It's a very common trick you find in negotiation games, but there are relatively few negotiation games. It's a really underexplored thing, I think, because it takes so much time is the problem. You know, when you properly have bartering and trading going on between games, get trading games, really, I should say, rather than negotiation games, getting a real trading circle going is very time consuming. So you tend to see it more in auction games. And what I find interesting about it is I really enjoy that. And that is part of what I mean when I say I enjoy watching people put on the block or being on the block. It's being in that teeth of a dilemma of not being sure whether this is something you have to bid on or something whether you have not to bid on because you don't know the value. And because the final values of things in modern art are far more variable and uncertain because of the endgame scoring mechanic and because of the way that you pay the player who plays the card, I think that's what it's missing for me. It makes it much, much harder to get those aha moments where you know you've got somebody or you know that you are the person that's on the hook.
Yeah. There's a lot of retroactively good moves that you didn't realize were good moves at the time. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. I suppose that's part of it, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, that was something I definitely felt in my playthrough. Was like, it is hard to sort of grok the value of a thing you're doing.
And you couldn't have done it better at the time.
Yeah.
This is the thing. So one way of understanding that could be, well, I've learned from that, I'll do better next time. But you can't do that with modern art. It's a game you much more have to feel your way around. You can look back and go, oh yeah, well, it was great that I put down that bid for that painting, but there was no way you could have known at the time that it was going to be a great bid for a great painting. It's the benefit of hindsight. You're looking very puzzled there, Nate. You don't agree.
No, I was thinking of something else. I was actually thinking of, because the whole nature of you put a card up for auction, you are boosting that card's value, you know, by the fact that it's out there at all, because the person who sold the most paintings is the one. And so I actually think if I have any beef with this game, and it's really not actually a problem to me, but if I have any criticism, it's that the double auction cards that Ian has already talked about, those are really important because a set of those can completely change the game or change the round, I should say. It's like there will suddenly just be, you know, twice as many paintings out by a specific artist in one round. And if you... And so having them in your hand, you have a lot of control over the rhythm of the round. Now, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you only have double auction cards. I've had that happen. And you have to pair them with a non-double auction card. Or sometimes you have it, but no one's going to want to buy them. You're the only one. So this is all the kind of stuff that happens. But if you have a couple of those, you have a lot of flexibility. If you don't have those, you have some challenges. I don't think it's a big issue. I like that kind of card management, but I think some people might feel like they're a little too strong. I don't, but I can see the argument.
Yeah, I think that speaks a little bit to what Matt was saying about pace of the game as well, and how the sort of rhythm of it feels, because a round can just suddenly close out. Mm-hmm. You think you're in okay position, and then suddenly it's over and you're not in a good position, and it's like, whoa, what just happened? And that those double auction cards are usually responsible for that happening. It can change in a blink of an eye. But you've got a few rounds, so hopefully you recover, maybe.
Okay, so moving on, what do we think are the influences on the current era? What has this game brought forward to the modern market in its 30 years of being in and out of print?
You know, it's weird. I think that the main influence this game has had has already kind of bloomed and withered. And it's not a criticism of the game, but the idea of just a plain old auction game, that's kind of passé now. Like, that's a very late 90s, early aughts kind of thing. A lot of games have auctions, but just having one, like, you know, like the for a while there, it was like the most classic thing. It was like, oh, the 20, 30 minute auction game, something like For Sale. For Sale is probably more influential there, but it's just not a genre that gets used as much anymore. And part of that is just because of the age of modern art, right? I mean, this is a 30-year-old game, 31 years. It's a time of recording. And so the cycle has kind of turned completely. I think that this game was helped a lot by the CMON edition. And I mean, helped a ton. First of all, it had been out of print for a long time, so there was a desire to see it. Second of all, CMON's a big company that, for, you know, they can afford good graphic design, and the new modern art edition has very nice graphic design. Like, it's a very intuitive, easy to grok, and in turn, you know, because not every hobby game is good at this, but modern art, it's like, yes, this is clean, it's clear, it's obvious what's happening. The other thing is like, compared to the most previous or to previous English language edition, was the Mayfair edition, which I think was unchanged in like 15 years. And the way the hobby changed from like 1996 to like, let's say, 2010 is like warp speed. Everything in the hobby changed. When that game was published, you could have really cheap components. You could have photocopied rules, which is what it had. And they didn't update it. By the time the game went out of print, it was like, it looked like a relic on the shelf. It did not look like something a new player would want to play. And so I think CMON's new edition has just made a huge difference that way. There's a really interesting, and Matt alluded to this earlier, but there's a really interesting thing that we can talk about with the CMON edition. And this is not an original thought with me. This is something I've been in discussions on forums and on social media about this before, but previously, old editions, they would use art that not like AI art, because that's like a very 2023 thing to do, but art that was just like kind of generic sludge art. It was not good by any sense at all. It was mostly variations on the same, like, it looked like someone took a really big painting and then took little chunks of it and put it on the cards. And not a good big painting either. And there were five artists, and they all had these personalities. One of them kind of looked like, you know, stained sheet metal. One of them looked like, you know, kind of bad cubism sort of thing. And this is kind of what they did. The CMON edition changed that by getting real artists, honest to goodness artists. And if you get that edition, you'll see that in the book, they actually have a little art book for all the artists, and you get to see all their work. You get to see them outside of the little cards, but that's what's on the cards. Before, when you're talking about a game that has trash art and is about the idea of FOMO and groupthink and things being valuable just because we decided they're valuable, as Matt said, that gives the game like this really kind of satirical, kind of biting edge to it. But when you put real artists who do real work, and I've shown this stuff, I'm assuming, in galleries and stuff like that, that completely changes that. Now it is just a game about buying art. And I don't actually think one is worse than the other. I just think it's just interesting that kind of does change the feel of the game a little bit thematically. And I don't think it's a weakness, but I see Ian kind of wobbling his head back and forth like he's not sure he agrees with me. So maybe he should speak up next.
Yeah, well, I think the case of using real artists actually lends a feeling of legitimacy to what you're doing, because ostensibly you're meant to be like your little like cardboard thing in front of you in the CMO audition anyway is like a little art gallery thing. So it's different art galleries around the world. I can't remember which ones it is, but you are meant. I think you're meant to be like people from those galleries going around the world and buying this art in terms of the actual sort of theming of it. I think that actually lends a bit more satirical elements to it. The fact that they are real artists out there in the world. You could go to a gallery in Edinburgh and go and look at some of these people's arts if they were exhibiting. I think that gives a bit more satirical element to it, the fact that these are real people and real art, that you could probably look up the valuation of those pieces online right now if you wanted to. I have no idea what they're worth, but you could do that. And yeah, the game definitely has that sort of satirical element to it. Because, like you say, Nate, and we've discussed a few times during this cast, is like the value of each of those pieces of art, it doesn't matter what they're actually worth. It matters what the people around the table at that moment have decided what it's worth. Maybe this Picasso is worth nothing to everyone around this table, but Monet's fantastic. Those are not artists in the game. I can't remember what the artists are, but you know what I mean. Like, so a bunch of people decide like this is worth something, and artist A is worth something, and artist B is worth absolutely nothing. I don't know if the previous editions had the big tarot cards, because the CMON edition, the cards they're pretty large. They're sort of tarot sized, basically.
I think they were like euro sized cards in the we would call a euro sized card in the Mayfair edition that I played.
Yeah, so they're bigger cards in this edition. That really lends something to the game, I think, because you get to see the actual art on there. Like as Nate says, the graphic design is excellent. It's very clean. There's not a lot of symbols in there. There's just five types of symbols basically to learn, and you know those after the first couple of auctions. You're done basically learning the game once you're couple of rounds in. And I think it's a game where the production is actually really key. Like, all of us on this cast have like cast doubt on like Kickstarter and like, you know, big huge productions that are overly complicated, loads of miniatures, loads of sort of over the top production, but good, like solid production can really, really help a game. And I think in this case, this is a game that really benefits from it. To my mind, one of the best parts of the CMON edition is the tiny hammer. Because it just lends a bit of theater to things. Like people are like tapping that hammer to like close out an auction. And the game is theater, like, to a certain extent. It is going to crash with some groups, because they might not just gel with that theater. But if you've got a group that really gets into it, that really calls those auctions, that the rule book encourages you to describe the art. And it doesn't matter if you don't know who that artist is, you can just describe the art in whatever way you want. And we had some ridiculous descriptions of the art because we had no idea what these people were, but you're encouraged to describe and sell the art to the people who are going to be bidding on it. And when you close out, you're banging a little hammer on the table and it's theater. And that's great. It's just a lovely thing. We were sitting in like a pretty crowded cafe, banging hammers and like shouting about auctions, and people are looking at us funny, but who cares? It's a really, really good experience. And it's such a good experience out of a really, really tight rule set. As we said earlier, there's four pages of rules. It's incredibly quick to learn. Once you've around one auction, you kind of know what all the auctions are. You don't see the depth of the game till maybe the end of your first game, I would say, for sure. There are different layers in there, but yeah, it's a game where the production really matters, I think. And it's a really good body. Like, the CMON edition has a nice insert, like little tokens for all the money. All the tokens have somewhere to go. Like, it's just a really good product. And it's pretty cheap. It's like 30 quid, something like that in the UK.
I think it was about $35 when I bought it, which has been like 5 years now. But
yeah, it's like 30, 40 quid in the UK. It's not expensive at all. And it's just a really, really nice product and a really good game.
I am inclined to agree with Ian, I must say, as it comes from the frisson, if you like, of using real artists. Because whenever I play it with that CMON edition, I am kind of reminded of the fact that the world is full of extremely talented artists who have sunk without trace. And it could well be that some of these artists have sunk without trace, you know, in their artistic careers. Yeah. We don't even know. And you're kind of almost mimicking that process of taste making, arbitrary taste making for the sake of the market.
Yeah, well, and in some ways it actually changes what the satire is. Now it's not a satire about phonies who are just making a lot of money because people decided they were famous. It's about the capriciousness and the arbitrary nature of art collection in the first place.
Yeah, and like what's popular at a given moment in time is just kind of part of the zeitgeist. It's just, yeah, it's almost arbitrary. Yeah, you can try and work at it. You can try and, like, you know,
if lightning strikes you, good for you.
Yeah, you can try and increase your follower count and things like that. But if suddenly, like, Jay Leno decides that your thing is, like, you know, worth a lot of money, or, you know, the president of the United States, like, displays a bit of your art in the White House, suddenly that's it. You're suddenly making the big bucks. And that's just hubris and luck a lot of the time.
Yep. And, you know, it is kind of, I find it really interesting how the different physical editions of this game bring forth these disparate aspects of the theme. I can't think of another game that's done that. I think that's pretty unique. And I also think, while we're on the subject of satire, or perhaps more irony, I am hugely amused by the fact that CMON, a company who are known for making ridiculously overproduced, lavish, miniature-graced Kickstarter extravaganzas, are responsible for one of the best value packages in modern gaming at the end of the spectrum. And at the same time, a game which is, as Nate pointed out, a satire of its own fear of missing out marketing model.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's kind of mind-blowing, yeah. You know, the only thing that's missing out of that edition, some of the other editions have got like a little easel that you put the card on.
Yeah, I'm not sure any of the English editions.
There's not that in the CMON edition. I think there's a Japanese edition that's got that in it.
Yeah, or maybe Brazilian edition. There's a lot of, actually, if you're interested in doing this, you can go on the gallery and Board Game Geek, and there's a ton of international editions of this game, some of which are really entertaining. There's some that are really just elaborate productions, and some that are not so great, but just there's a huge variety of it because they all get different art.
Yeah, I mean, what you could, if you wanted to, I guess you could print your own deck with your favorite artist in it. Because all you need is the symbols, right? But you should buy it.
You know, actually, so I just thought of something, and I didn't put this in the show notes, so I'm going rogue here. Is that fine?
No, terrible.
Okay. I actually wonder if one of the reasons this game is kind of having a moment now is because so much of our world revolves around clout chasing. And around FOMO and around just this groupthink. And there's an element now that this we are living, we are swimming in these waters now of just capricious, stupid influence and sudden fame, like you're the main character of Twitter today, or so, you know, this kind of stuff. And it's just because someone decided to pay attention to you that day. And the right person decided to pay attention to you that day. And there's something about this that actually, like, clicks with people now that didn't resonate 15 years ago, because that's not the world we lived in at the time. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very valuable point, but you should definitely like and subscribe to this podcast. No. It's a completely fair point. I'm being facetious. No, yeah, it is a good point, because, yeah, we do live in that culture of, like, lots of, like temporary fame and like I'll give you an example from this last week, right? I wrote a review of Tears of the Kingdom, the latest Zelda game, and that's a good few months old now. I didn't really expect anything of it. I just wanted to write about it, put it up on the site, and that absolutely exploded for me for a couple of days, like thousands and thousands of views on the site. I maybe get a couple of hundred in a day normally. The algorithm just caught it randomly.
Yeah. Back in my board game blogging days, which has now been about 10 years since I've really done that actively, but I would have, like, you could always tell, today someone posted my thing to our board games.
Yeah.
And suddenly, like, my views just, like, skyrocket. And the biggest thing for me was one time I asked another guy and said, hey, listen, if you get a chance, I would love a plug, another reviewer, someone else who I don't think is active now anymore either. But I just kind of, because I'm like, I'm trying to make a name for myself. And he did. And it made a really big difference.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was random. Like, I never knew what would get people fired up. And it wasn't something I meant to do half the time. It would just be like, oh, I've reviewed a game positively most people don't like, or vice versa. Or I made this particular point and everyone's kind of harping on it now. And it was a really weird ecosystem, and there was just no rhyme or reason to it. And that can be modern art sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, interesting thought. Yeah, it's a very interesting reflection of, like, the modern times. Yeah, I haven't thought about it that way. Interesting.
So as we have brought ourselves up to date, I think it's time to wrap proceedings and suggest whether we recommend this for our listeners or not.
Well, as the newest person to this game out of three of us, I'm enthused. I mean, I want to play it more. I am waiting for the reprint to buy a copy for myself. Like I said earlier in the cast, it feels kind of party game-ish, but with a lot more bite to it than like your sort of casual party game. It's definitely a game that's going to live and die with the group you play it with, for sure. Like for some groups, I'm like we talked about in Cosmic Encounter, I'm sure for some groups this game's just going to bomb and you're just going to bounce off it, and that's totally fair. But I think it's a really great game. I really enjoyed my play of it. I'm looking forward to playing it more. I think it's a good first Knizia game as well, to like sort of introduce you to like how good he is at designing games with a paucity of rules that give you a really interesting game out of those rules. Like just not many rules to them, but just a really interesting experience out of them. And it doesn't really have any of the scoring mechanisms that he's famous for, which I'm sure we'll talk about in some later episode. But it does show that light touch he has with rules, I think. And like I said, the CMON production is just really good, apart from the missing tiny easel. It's a very good production. It's got the little wooden hammer in there. Lean into it, have a good time with it, ham it up, because you'll get the most out of it, and you'll have a really good time.
You love that little wooden hammer, don't you, Ian?
It's great. It's fantastic.
See it with your finger. So for all you potential publishers, if you just made a game of only little hammers, Ian would kickstart that game. He would back it right away.
Just hitting hammers all the time. Yeah. Awesome. 10 out of 10. No notes.
I can't give this a total recommendation. There are several auction games I mentioned earlier that I would play in preference to this. I would play Ra. It is an all-time favorite of mine. And if you are listening to this podcast, I don't doubt you're enough of a gamer to handle its bizarre scoring mechanic at the end game.
New edition of it out recently as well.
Furnace, I mentioned earlier, is a really, really nice modern twist on the auction game where you are, it's similar to Ra in some respects. You've got fixed bidding tokens that you use to bid on parts for a machine that you turn into a production line to try and generate better resources. It's really quite a cool concept. But if you can't or won't, for whatever reason, sort of like engage with those games, then Modern Art is right up there. It is a hugely influential and fun auction game, and you will have a great time with it if you choose to.
Like, only thing I can say to that is, ¿por qué no los dos? Why not both? They're both outstanding games. I do prefer Ra. I'm going to go with Matt on that. I like that game more. But I think Ian is actually pretty right when he says that this is a good... If you're interested in getting into Reiner Knizia games, first of all, this is a very visible game of his. And it's you know, by the time you listen to this, it will probably be out in distribution streams again.
I think UK was meant to be November was meant to be hitting stores
okay,
again.
So yeah, we're recording this in November in 2023. By the time you hear it, yeah, it ought to be. So it's easily available. It's affordable. It's a great first game. It because of the four pages of rules, and because of this, if you have familiarity with bidding and auctioning and other games, and just if you're interested in that kind of thing, like Dr. Knizia, then it's a good choice for you. It will. It does ask you to like become familiar with the game. It will. It's fun the first time. It's not like Ian is a testament to that, but it pays off better if you kind of get a feel for it. And it is. It's not an easy feel because it's a very amorphous game. It kind of squirms away when you think you have it nailed down. So because of that, just give it some time. And it gets my recommendation for sure. It's a great one. It's aged very well. I can't think of another 30-year-old game that has, you know, nearly the same kind of relevance as this one does.
Okay, thanks very much. And with that, I think we'll say good night from everybody. And I would urge both our listeners and my fellow co-host to find some sort of protective object to wear in advance of next season, the next podcast that we have coming out.
I'll look some of that in my drawers. Bye for now, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks very much for listening. Editing for the cast was done by me, Ian McAllister. The music for the cast was provided by my brother-in-law, David Oliver, with my friend, Alistair McLeod. Our logo was created by Rachel Wines-Thrower. If you like what you've listened to, then the best way to help us out is by telling your friends about us and leave us a review and rating on your podcast host of choice. You can follow the hosts on various social media platforms, and we'll put links to all of those in our show notes. You can come and chat to the team and fellow game enthusiasts in our Discord, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can do so through our Patreon. Links to both of those will be in the show notes as well. If you'd like to contact us about any of the games we've covered on the cast, should cover, or anything else really, you can contact us at cultoftheolduk@gmail.com. Bye for now.